This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Next up, how does a nuclear waste problem in Great Britain compare to America?
Radio EcoShock.
What happens when you collect a lifetime of atomic waste on a small island in the North Atlantic? Nothing good. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is an accomplished nuclear engineer. He's advised teams raising damaged nuclear submarines, written reports for Greenpeace and Friends of Earth, testified as an expert witness. He's appeared on international media countless times. Radio EcoShock is pleased to welcome back Britain's John Large. Hello, John.
Hi.
Well, John, I'd like to focus in this interview on the never-ending problem of what to do with atomic waste. But first, tell us briefly about your testimony that helped close the San Onofre nuclear power station in California.
Well, it was relatively straightforward. Southern Edison, the operator, decided to change these very large components called steam generators in the power plant. They spent 30 years of operation. They were rattling, so they needed to be replaced. They put an order with Mitsubishi for around $500 million for four replacement units. Mitsubishi produced those, shipped them across from Japan, cut their way into the reactor, fitted these, and within a year, they'd shaken themselves to pieces. My job was to do the analysis and decide whether or not those plants could be repaired within the required safety margins. My opinion was it couldn't, but not because of my evidence, but generally what happened was Edison, the operator, threw in the towel and announced mid-last year that these plants will be closed down permanently. A very interesting victory for Friends of the Earth. This was the first time in my recollection that a group, an environmental group, has actually closed down nuclear power plants. So quite a success in that respect.
Hopefully, many more to come. I'd like to get back to the UK. Unfortunately, I remember the years when Great Britain dumped its atomic waste right into the Atlantic Ocean in rather flimsy barrels, I thought. And I shudder to think what happens when those barrels release their burden of uranium and plutonium. But now that's stopped, and partly due to Greenpeace, I must say. What is Great Britain doing with its nuclear waste now?
Nothing. It's in limbo. Effectively, Britain hasn't got a final waste strategy. It's leaving the generated waste at the situations, the locations where it's generated. So at the moment, if a nuclear power plant generates nuclear waste, other than some very low levels of nuclear waste, all of that waste has to be retained on the site of generation. The present government strategy is to determine a nuclear waste repository site by 2040 and to have that in place by about 2004-05. In the meantime, nuclear fuel is accumulating, radioactive waste from operations of nuclear power plants is accumulating, and in total, at today, from its legacy of nuclear power research and development and operation, including for the decommissioning of nuclear power stations, the existing ones in the UK, not the new generation at the moment, Britain has about 4.5 million cubic meters of waste that will require long-term management. So a legacy which is assessed to cost around 70 to 100 billion pounds sterling. That's the legacy of nuclear power in the UK at the moment.
And John, talk to us about the risks of accumulating mountains of bomb-grade plutonium in the UK.
Well, there's another problem, because Britain in the late 40s decided to go alone on a nuclear weapons program. Look, the story was simple. America favored the enriched uranium route. Churchill approached the Americans and said, could they provide the materials because of the post-war shortages in the 40s to Britain? Could America provide those materials so it could go along the enriched uranium route itself? It required some very high-spec copper piping, which it didn't have. The Americans turned it down flat. They didn't want Britain joining the nuclear club, even though British scientists were shipped out to Canada at the beginning of the war and worked on this project with the Americans. So they were keen to come back to Britain and to actually develop their own nuclear weapon. So what happened very briefly was that because they were refused the enriched uranium route, Britain went into the plutonium route. It decided to produce a plutonium bomb. And that was its strategy. And to do that, it required to actually reprocess reactor fuel. And what we see in Britain is the gas-cooled reactor, graphite-moderated reactor, being developed, because that was an ideal plutonium breeder. But even the reactor program that we had, the civil reactors, which are doubling up for military production, even that wasn't big enough. So Britain went round the world in the 50s and 60s particularly, gathering up fuel reprocessing contracts to be completed at Windscale, which was renamed Sellafield. All of that activity of overseas fuel, domestic fuel, reprocessing, has produced one of the largest plutonium stockpiles in the world. We have about 120 tons of weapons-grade plutonium in storage at Sellafield at this moment. And that is a real problem because although we've gone along what's called the MOX route, the mixed oxide fuel route, to try and convert that plutonium into fuel for the thermal reactors, like the PWRs, that's not been successful at all. There's a great deal of difficulty in producing the very, very high quality required for MOX fuel to run in these reactors. So Britain really is embarrassed. It has 120-odd tons of fissile plutonium, which is an enormous safety and security threat that has to be looked after.
Is it true that the UK is taking in even more nuclear waste from abroad even today?
Well, it's still got its contracts. It's still taking on reprocessing contracts. And, of course, the deal's like this, that we take in the overseas fuel from Japan, Spain, Germany. That fuel is then reprocessed. That means the fuel is taken in, it's dissolved in nitric acid. Then it sort of goes through a solvent dissolution process, which picks out the plutonium. So it's a separation to extract the plutonium. Scouring the world for fuel and to reprocess the fuel results in three products. The plutonium, tiny amounts of plutonium for each ton batch of fuel that's reprocessed that goes into the fissile stockpile. High-level waste, which is usually vitrified into a glass slug that is sent back to the overseas country, and that comprises all the fission products. And then a mountain of intermediate-level waste, which is not fission product generally, but activated product, which Britain has to keep. And what it does, it says to the overseas country, look, instead of sending you tons and tons and tons of intermediate-level waste back, what we do is we'll substitute a little bit of high-level waste. So we'll keep back these great big bowels of intermediate-level waste, and we'll send you back a bucket full of high-level waste. This is called substitution. Of course, the problem is that the overseas customer gets a small volume that it's required to manage for several hundred thousand years, and Britain retains a very large volume of lesser radioactive but still very long-lived, tens of thousands of years, intermediate-level waste. It's that waste, that intermediate-level waste, that's held back by this substitution mechanism that is now accumulating as a legacy for the British to actually manage in the long term.
What a great business. It's hard to see how that benefits anyone in the British public, but we won't even get into that. Now, John, I recently found out one of the things that's being advanced as a way to store this waste is to put it in dry casks, in cement casks. But I recently found out from a recording in the United States, these storage casks are not sealed at all. They have an intake and a vent. Are they releasing nuclear radiation, or could water flow through them?
Well, that's the real problem, isn't it? Because when you talk about the lifetime, look, you can look after radioactive waste in two phases. You can have the institutional phase where there's some intervention required from mankind. In other words, you need to store it, cool it, have emergency systems if anything goes wrong. And then you have the post-institutional period where the waste could be put in its container down into a deep geological hole, sealed up, and left there forever and a day. The problem is with some of these wastes, the time scales that you have to prevent the waste reaching man's environment, in other words, the surface, say leaking in the depths of a geological repository about 600 meters deep, and then working its way through the geological barriers, that time scale is so long that it's virtually impossible to engineer an artificial containment or even use geological containments with certainty to ensure that some future generation doesn't receive a dose. And the real problem is that if you make a mistake in the packaging, the geological disposal, the location of the repository, if there's water migrating through it, then under these timescales, there's very little you can do once a mistake's been made. If you make an error and the waste gets out by a factor of 10 or 100 or 1,000 times faster, then there's no way you can stop this horse race completing its course.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with British nuclear expert John Large. We are talking about the building burden of highly radioactive nuclear waste. John, the American nuclear power plants have spent fuel pools, just like in Fukushima, but the American ones are bulging with high-level waste. Are British facilities similarly overloaded?
No, what has happened in Britain is this, is of course, because of this reprocessing aspect, most of the plants send their fuel. Once the fuel comes out the reactor, it goes into the spent fuel ponds for a period between 3 to 5 years. Then it trundles off by rail to Sellafield up in the northwest, where it's reprocessed or stored and reprocessed later on. So we have most of our reactors, apart from one or two, the fuel is contracted to be reprocessed. So we take away this major hazard from the nuclear plants and transfer it to a single plant, Sellafield. And in many ways, some people argue, and it can be argued confidently, this is, in terms of security, safeguarding the plant from malicious attack, for example, it's much better to have the radioactive waste in one location where you can beef up security rather than scattered around the country at 20 or 30 nuclear power plants. America has this problem. Of course, one of the problems is this, is that typically a nuclear power plant will produce about 30 to 40 tons of waste every 18 months to 2 years. And it will do that repeatedly year after year after year that it's been operating. So the spent fuel builds up. What has happened in the United States is that the operators have eked out the life of the power plants and gone for extensions to life. They've modified and gone for a life extension, which means the power plants are now operating not for 25 years, but for 45 years and greater. That means that the original storage ponds are not large enough to take this ongoing accumulating waste, that was spent fuel that comes from the reactors. So what they've done is they've then reverted to high-density racking. That's where they cram more fuel rods, more fuel assemblies into the same space. And, of course, that introduces different types of hazards and different types of risk of release. And, of course, the major difficulty now of Fukushima is trying to safeguard particularly Reactor 4, the fuel pond, which is up there 4 stories at the top of that building. They're trying to unload that fuel now because that's a major risk. And what can happen at a nuclear power plant is that the amount of radioactivity actually stored in the water pond after a few years, relatively short years, after about 10, 12, 15 years, depending on the reactor plant, the radioactivity in the fuel pond is greater than the moderately long-term radioactivity in the operating reactor. But the problem becomes is that the reactor has got all sorts of secondary containment strapped around it, the containment dome that characterizes the architecture of a nuclear power plant, whereas the actual fuel ponds are relatively flimsy in their defense against an accident, and particularly a terrorist attack or an aircraft crash or whatever. So that is the present problem, the dilemma that the power plants have fallen into by going for life extensions.
And those spent fuel pools, they need to be cooled all the time, but what if the external power goes down or the generators fail to start and run out of fuel? What happens?
You have generally on a power plant, it depends on what part of the cycle of the reactor refuel cycle you're in. Or indeed, if the reactor has been completely, the fuel core of the reactor has been completely discharged, about 110, 120 tons, has been put into the fuel pond on a temporary basis, while, say, the reactor is undergoing a 5-year or 10-year periodic inspection, then you have a lot of heat-generating fuel in the pond. Typically, you would have about between 10 and 20 hours before the water boils down in a pond. So if you lose your diesel generators, go for a station blackout where there's no alternate power, you lose your off-site power and your diesel generators, you have about 10 or 20 hours, depending on the plant, to actually make good that water shortage. Of course, if you lose the pond water by some accident, by some rupture of the tank or whatever, then the problem becomes very much more immediate, and the fuel can overheat within a matter of 10, 20, 30 minutes, and then you can run into this very interesting reaction between the zirconium clad, the zircalloy clad, that's an aluminium of zirconium that clads the actual fuel itself, these very fine rods. What happens at in steam at high temperature, about 600 degrees C in a steamy atmosphere, is that the zircalloy tries to go rusty. And to do that, it strips the oxygen out of the steam and leaves hydrogen. So you now have a combustive, if not explosive, atmosphere around the fuel. And that was, of course, what happened at Fukushima. The fuel overheated. It went through a zirconium steam reaction, produced hydrogen, and the hydrogen did the damage.
Given what happened at Fukushima Daiichi, it's amazing that Britain is planning to build another new reactor. How far along are those plans and who is opposing it?
Well, we have, at the moment, we have an announcement. We just had an announcement about a month ago that a plant in Somerset, Hinkley Point C, is to go ahead. That's two big reactors, two 1,600 megawatt reactors, PWRs built by the French. That's got the go-ahead. They will now trundle through their construction and commissioning phases and probably come in line in about 2020, be online. And there's another two reactors have now been announced for a part of Wales on Anglesey to be built by Hitachi, consortium Hitachi. So irrespective of Fukushima, the British government is committed to nuclear power at the moment because it makes up its mix of electrical generating capacity from the renewables like the windmills, turbines, air turbines, and nuclear power makes up that essential renewable, so it's committed to it. And quite frankly, I mean, some critics would say that they've turned a convenient Nelsonian blind eye to Fukushima. We we argue here that it's quite comical, really. We argue that the British regulatory system is far superior to that of anywhere else in the world. And after all, tsunamis don't really happen here, so there's nothing to worry about. Of course, what one conveniently forgets is the first major nuclear accident in the world was actually at Windscale, Sellafield, in the 50s.
Suppose, John Large, the public does wake up and wants this threat of nuclear power ended. Can it be done without putting the British public back into medieval times?
I believe so. I mean, if I was to say to my long-gone father, look here, Dad, today I use so many kilowatts of electricity. I mean, he was a modern man, he would be astonished at the amount of electricity or energy that I as an individual had consumed in my home. So there's a lot of fat to be cut off here. We could certainly take some control over how we use and particularly how we manage electricity. You know, look, I think every country has tried smart meters, white meters. Perhaps what we need to do is actually not give the public the choice of when it uses its electricity. We should perhaps take devices like washing machines, and fit those with a smart chip that says, sorry, I've monitored, this chip is monitoring the electricity supply in your area. It's not a good time to do your washing, your laundry. So therefore, we'll hold you off. You can do it in 2 hours' time when I say. I think we've got to place some autonomy in the system that says to the public, no, you can't make the decision. We will make the decision. If we're able to micromanage our electricity consumption, our energy use, then the demand would come down.
Is there anything I haven't touched on that you would like to tell us about today?
Well, just terrorism, I think, is a real problem for us at the moment.
Right. Are British fuel pools, are they hardened against, for example, an airplane coming in?
What we have in Britain is a wonderful Act of Parliament called the Freedom of Information Act, which enables us, the public, to ask questions of them, the government. And that question is often asked. You know, what resilience has been put into our nuclear power plants, particularly the fuel ponds, which are considered to be rather vulnerable? What resilience has been put in following 9/11 in the States and, of course, our own terrorist attack in 2007 on the tube systems? And under the Freedom of Information Act, there's one clause, one qualified exemption, that says, well, the government doesn't have to tell you this if it affects national security. And that's what it says. We won't tell you because it will affect national security, so therefore we don't know the extent to which the resilience, to the extent to which the surety of our fuel ponds has now been beefed up against our quite obvious terrorist threat. Well, look, one of the problems with terrorism is that our nuclear power plants were primarily designed to withstand accidents. And accidents are, by their very nature, accidental. They're not intelligent, intentional events. But, of course, a terrorist event is an intentional, intelligent event that seeks out the vulnerabilities of the system. And if that system is a nuclear power plant, it doesn't take much imagination or much resource for an individual, a terrorist, to find out the weaknesses of the plant. And in many ways, you're given hints of this by the system. The establishment will strengthen up those parts of the plant that it considers to be vulnerable. So there's a symbiotic relationship between the establishment, the state, and the terrorist, knowing full well that if you harden up the defense of one part, that means that's the strong part, you can move to another part, and so on and so forth. So it's a difficult area that we don't seem to be managing very well.
Our guest is the principal of the nuclear consulting firm Large & Associates. He's an expert witness and nuclear engineer with decades of experience. Find some links to his work in my show blog at ecoshock.info. I'm Alex Smith, saying thank you, John Large, for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
Thank you.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.